What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top, located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
Howdy, y'all. Well, this is Jeff, and we are at EMS World Expo, and I am sitting here with Dr. Dave Wampler. He is from the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio, and he is presenting three different research projects. And I want to have a conversation with him about what he is looking at, what clinical question he's trying to answer, and what he found. So, Dr. Wampler, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Did I get all the titles right?
Absolutely.
Same place?
Yes.
I like it. Well, let's just get right to it. Why don't we start off with a paper? You're doing some weird stuff, man. You're like going around snorting isopropyl alcohol. What's up with that?
I love snorting alcohol. Especially when I don't feel well. If I've got a little man flu, yeah, and I'm getting a little bit nauseated, if I can sniff, so that's much better, I think, than taking a pill.
There you go. Well, what is the... This is a poster, or this is a paper?
This is a poster. This is a podium presentation, and this is the project that won Research of the Year at EMS World Expo.
Outstanding. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's quite the feat. There's some good research being presented here.
There's a lot of really impressive work being presented here today.
I am so excited when I come around. You know, I've been going, just like you have, to EMS conferences for a long time, and it's sort of been a dearth of research. And it's so exciting. You know, you look at this compared to ASAP or NAMSP, where it's just almost all research. And then you come here and you're like, what the hell? What's going on? And now, as I was walking up, posters everywhere. Mm-hmm. So I think this is outstanding. I'm so excited to see them do this.
I think we have the right inertia. Before, we had the wrong kind of inertia where we can't get things going. Now, we have so many people who are starting to really ask questions, and now we've got these huge data sets that we can start to answer some of the questions.
Yeah.
We're going in good places.
I like it. Well, it's a whole lot easier when you're not having to collate paper charts, isn't it?
True.
I hate those days. Well, let's get back to SNP. Apparently, by the way, the rage this day is to snort condoms. Have you seen that?
I have not seen that, okay. And I'm hoping they're unused.
Yeah, I hope so. So I'm trying to do a talk on the highlights of this podcast. Basically, what are the research papers we've covered? And I'm trying to do it all in memes. So I sent an email to John Gonzalez at Williamson County and said, hey, John, you're a meme master. What would you recommend? And he said, I swear to God, Jeff, this is a thing. You got to Google it. And I Googled it. And oh, my God, I worry about the future of our society.
Well, at least we're not doing Tide Pods.
Yeah, exactly. I think they may like empty Tide Pods into condoms and then... Yeah, I don't know. Well, anyway, I'm getting a little nauseous just thinking about this. You have anything on you that might be able to help me with that nausea?
Don't. I have a tourniquet. Would that be helpful?
Hopefully not. I mean, maybe I'm going to shoot myself in the foot here, but and maybe need to put a tourniquet on.
So what we're really interested in is looking to see if isopropyl alcohol is at least equivalent to some of the traditional treatments using ondansetron.
Okay.
This idea came from really post-op patients who have this really bad, these bad nausea episodes when they're emerging from anesthesia. It's just an old recovery nurse's trick to let them sniff a little bit of alcohol, and they've actually shown that it works pretty well. And so my thought is, well, if it works on those patients with this really nasty cause of nausea, maybe it'll work in our population even though our population, nausea is such a wide differential. There's so many causes and so many different reasons why some of our EMS patients may be nauseated.
So I think there was an analyst paper about this in the emergency department and, mm-hmm. and then post-op, like you mentioned. So you're getting a gallon of isopropyl and like waterboarding them with it?
That's another option. That's not the one that we went with. We just took three of the large alcohol prep pads, tore them in half, handed them to the patient, and said, whenever you feel like you have a wave of nausea, just sniff the pads. It's self-administered. And we did this comparing head-to-head with a randomized control trial study design against regular IV ondansetron.
Nice. So what was the population you were using?
San Antonio Fire Department EMS patients.
So undifferentiated nausea, all cause.
Correct.
Adults, pediatrics?
Only adults.
And what did you define that as?
Over 18.
18.
The legal definition. This is a UT Health Science Center approved IRB determined study. And so we limited it to those patients that are convenient and easy to study.
So how did you handle a consent?
So we actually were granted a waiver of informed consent. So we didn't have to go through the multi-page document to get them to consent. Basically, we had to explain the study. We had to tell them that it's voluntary and give them their options of opting in or opting out. And once they opted in, then that's when we broke the randomization
kit. Yeah. So you actually did do consent. It wasn't like the rock trials where they're doing the exception from, what is it, the emergency exception?
Right, the EFIC trials, exception from informed consent. No, we did consent them.
Okay,
we didn't have to go through the full process. It was just abbreviated.
Okay.
Because our IRB really sort of determined that this was a minimal risk study.
Yeah.
And so because...
It's aromatherapy, for God's sakes.
No, it is aromatherapy. It's staying essentially outside the body. And I think really there's probably more risk in starting an IV mm-hmm. and giving them an IV medication than having them sniff.
But thankfully, that's standard of care. So
that is standard of care.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. And then how'd you randomize?
So we bought little plastic boxes. They were black. They look a little bit like a gun box.
Okay.
And inside the box was the information sheet and either three isopropyl alcohol packets or one IV dose vial of ondansetron and the syringe. So inside the box, once they opened it up, that's how they knew which arm that patient was randomized to. And they had all the equipment that they needed to go.
So when you did the randomization, not for basically when you came up with them and made the kits, was this designed as a one-to-one or were you doing clusters?
Okay. Yes, no, it's a one-to-one.
And then what did you base your power calculation on?
So we didn't really know. We did essentially a convenience sample. We wanted the study to take about 6 months.
Okay.
And so we just estimated how many patients we thought we could get in within 6 months. And then we cut that in about a quarter, and that's what we based it off of.
So obviously you couldn't blind this. It's going to be kind of challenging to do that.
So that's one of the criticisms that we've gotten. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
We don't have saline swabs.
Yep.
And I didn't want to go through the extra risk of injecting saline into an IV.
Yeah.
So it is unblinded. But it is randomized prior to the patient knowing which arm they're going to go into.
Okay. So all adult patients, undifferentiated nausea, randomized on a one-to-one basis to, and I'm sorry, eight or four of Zofran?
Four
of ondansetron, and then three isopropyl pads, snorted PRN. So what were your outcomes? What was your primary outcome you were looking at?
So we used a 1 to 10 Likert scale of nausea, and it had little pictures, little happy guy was a zero, and a little green pukey guy was a 10.
The Mr. Yuck sticker?
Yep.
Nice.
And they...
it is. They it's just, a sad Mr. Yuck, too.
He is a sad Mr. Yuck.
He's not puking, though.
Because you're really green, nausea, though. He's really vomiting. Green.
He is. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's so our primary outcome was reduction of nausea on the Likert scale at 2-minute intervals up to either 10 minutes or arrival at the hospital.
So how I'm trying to think of how this would look. Now, were you measuring it as a continuous variable, or did you dichotomize it into?
It's a Likert scale, so it's a discontinuous variable, but so it's a number. One through 10.
So you didn't convert it into a proportion. It's like the proportion that had more than X percent reduction.
Right.
Okay. All right. And then were there any secondary outcomes that you're looking at?
No.
Okay.
It was just primary.
So why don't you tell us about the results? How many people did you get and what'd you find?
So we ended up with 84
So is that 84 per group or total?
Total.
Total. Okay.
There was no difference in the initial mean nausea score.
Okay.
P-value of 0.2.
Okay.
And essentially, there was no difference between alcohol and ondansetron.
In terms of your primary outcome, so reduction
primary outcome
of nausea.
Reduction
no
of nausea. Correct.
Interesting.
What we found was neither of them worked really well.
Yeah, yeah.
But they worked equally poorly.
Okay. So the, I guess one question here is, do you think that the reason that isopropyl worked as well as Zofran is that you're using inadequate doses of Zofran?
Potentially, and we're using it probably before Zofran is reached effectiveness. So we're starting at time zero is when we give the medication or hand them the alcohol swabs.
Okay.
And then we're measuring nausea Q2 minutes until either we reach the hospital or 10 minutes is where we stopped collecting data.
So when you were doing the comparison, were you doing one comparison at 2 minutes, one comparison at four? Or
yes.
Did you? Okay. So you really did say 5 to 10, depending on how long the transport was, comparisons?
Right. And as the longer you went out, sometimes we lost patients, you know, we had a 5-minute transport
right.
time. So we lost everybody past 5 minutes.
Okay.
And so the numbers did get smaller as we...
The sample size dropped down.
Correct.
Yeah, that makes sense. Did you notice any change in the efficacy of ondansetron the longer it had to work?
So in both cases, nausea level went down.
Okay.
Now, can I contribute that directly to... the either the ondansetron or the alcohol? No, because we're doing all the other stuff that
right.
EMS does, right? Patient comfort, transport, just knowing the patient knowing they're going to the hospital sometimes is very comforting and reduces
right.
pain, reduces nausea.
So that, from a methodology standpoint, let's call that factor X of all the other stuff. The beauty of randomizing this is that factor X should be roughly evenly distributed in both groups. So, excuse me, while that may be a contributor in overall decrease in nausea, it shouldn't say, well, that's the reason one did better than the other, or the reason neither did better than the other.
Right.
Okay. So what's the take on? What do you think we should get? What's your like Twitter?
So what makes me excited
yeah.
is both these medications made patients feel better.
Okay.
Isopropyl alcohol is way cheaper than ondansetron. You don't have to start an IV. And I think, you know, we haven't tested this in a BLS system, but I think this is easily a treatment for nausea that our BLS providers can do and actually make a real difference in patients' comfort on the way to the hospital.
So let's take a look at that and say, is there another research project that you could do to evaluate that in a BLS setting?
Oh, absolutely. So I want to do, there's several things I want to do here, right? So we tested on an undifferentiated patient population.
Right.
I wanted to repeat this on a critical illness scenario. So okay. Like, for example, patients who are having ST elevation MI, or really any kind of MI where they become nauseated, pretty common symptoms. Mm-hmm. Does it work in that population as well? Because now we really have something that our BLS providers can do to improve outcomes in patients. If we can, if our BLS providers who don't have ALS interceptor or other mechanism, if they can reduce the nausea, prevent that patient from vomiting, that patient's having a STEMI and vomiting, that's really bad.
Yeah, it doesn't help. So one thing I was thinking about when you talked about BLS is that sets you up to maybe repeat the trial and randomize it to, and I'm not sure how you would prepare these, but it doesn't seem like it would be that challenging. Isopropyl saturated gauze compared to saline saturated gauze, so you can get a placebo. I don't know how you're going to get around that smell, because it's probably the smell that's having the effect. But you might be able to get an idea.
It would be tough to blind that.
Yeah, it would.
But still, I think just the fact that you're randomizing it, you will get some valuable information from there.
That would be good. All right, perfect.
And because our BLS providers tend to be farther away, right? My study was done in San Antonio Fire Department, where we have, I mean, you can't throw a biscuit and not hit a hospital.
Right.
Our BLS providers tend to have much longer transport times. And so being able to intervene.
They'd have a pretty good biscuit throwing arm.
They'd have to have a really good biscuit throwing arm.
Nice. And especially if they're out, you know, San Antonio's in the hill country. There are a lot of twisty roads.
Absolutely.
That are nausea provoking. I know my guys in Marble Falls constantly have that. All right. Well, let's switch topics. You're also doing a paper, a poster on cardiac arrest, epidemiology of cardiac arrest. So I have a passing familiarity with this. I seem to remember we started this as a research project at the ESO Research Forum at WAVE last year.
Yes.
It was a fun project. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
So ESO has a really, really powerful research database. It's a national data set, and it's actually a registry, although I don't think we really got into a lot of the registry components here. We didn't really get outcomes from this, but what we were really focusing on is what is the incidence of EMS witnessed cardiac arrest.
As opposed to bystander or unwitnessed arrest.
Right. Somebody who arrests prior to EMS arrival. Mm-hmm. Presumably EMS did not have any opportunity to intervene.
Okay.
Once EMS has arrived, presumably now EMS is going to be intervening and hopefully preventing arrests.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about the population. You mentioned it was the ESO data set. Mm-hmm. So this was, what year was the data collected and how many, all that good stuff?
This was from the 2017 ESO research data set. I'm sorry, the 2018 mm-hmm. ESO research data set, which contained around 7.5 million records.
It's a big data set.
It is a huge data set and rich with potential to ask questions.
As a data nerd, I am just in, you know, it's like a pigsty for me. I'm like, oh, data I can roll around in. All right, so what was the population? What was the inclusion criteria here?
Our inclusion criteria were patients who had cardiac arrest, mm-hmm. and our subpopulation was cardiac arrest patients witnessed by EMS.
Now, is this adults, pediatrics?
Good question. that's a great question.
And I hate to do this to you because I'm thinking, God, I hope he remembers this, because I seem to remember actually crunching the numbers on this, and I don't remember what I did.
Okay, so yes, we excluded anybody less than the age of 18.
Perfect.
And we had 63,000 records with cardiac arrest.
That is a crap ton of adult cardiac arrest.
And 2,200 of those were pediatrics. So we took those out, which is only 4%
right.
of the cardiac arrests were pediatric. And so we ended up with 60,000, 60,500 adult cardiac arrests.
All right. And what proportion of those were witnessed by EMS personnel?
About 13%.
Okay.
So 8,000 patients had an EMS witness cardiac arrest.
Vast majority unwitnessed, or at least unwitnessed by EMS. They arrested prior to our arrival.
Yes.
All right. And then what were you looking for?
Well, so we really wanted to characterize this group of patients. The first look was, well, what's the age? Does that make any kind of a difference? And our ages were exactly what you would think. Those patients between 60 and 80 tended to have cardiac arrest more frequently than patients who were younger. In fact, mm-hmm. almost half of the patients in this group were between the ages of 60 and 80.
Okay.
The next sort of important piece is why do we think they arrested?
Okay.
Right. So we want to sort of focus on the cardiac arrest, right. But there's a lot of other reasons why the heart stops beating.
Yep.
Could be, you know, electrical issues. It could be trauma. If the patient bleeds out, the heart's still working. Mm-hmm. There's just no blood to move.
Sepsis, respiratory.
So
you're
arrest.
Asking about the etiology here, right?
The etiology, okay. Correct. And here again, it's about half of the patients had a presumed cardiac arrest.
I like the way you stress the word presumed.
Presumed.
Yeah.
Well, it's really hard. If there's not evidence for something else,
yep.
Then we have to presume that it's the heart, because I think really it is probably pretty close to half.
So it's interesting. So CARES defines that, and presumed cardiac really is the default. And I think that if you actually think about it, that will probably be, like you said, the majority of the cases. But if you have a patient who has, say, an 80-year-old in a nursing home who has a temperature of 104 and has had a productive cough, lymphoidic chest pain, and progressive shortness of breath over the last 4 days, and what the hell, why don't we go ahead and throw in a chest x-ray showing a focal infiltrate? That's not a cardiac etiology. That's respiratory.
Correct.
So that's pneumonia or an infectious etiology. But I would imagine that a fair number of EMS personnel would still call that cardiac etiology because, well, if it wasn't cardiac etiology, why would you call it cardiac arrest?
Right.
So I think that this is a challenge when we're looking at a large data set. So interesting. So what did you find out about the etiology? You said vast majority was
cardiac? So if 80%, if you take presumed cardiac and respiratory, that's 80% okay. of our population.
That's the vast majority.
There's another... About 10% were trauma, and then all the other potential causes, drug overdose, electrocution, okay. all the other pieces are in that small segment of that pie.
All right. What else did you find?
Well, we looked at initial rhythm. Did they arrest into a shockable rhythm or a non-shockable rhythm?
Okay.
And it's actually 2/3 of the patients went into some sort of a non-shockable rhythm, either okay. a PEA arrest or Brady asystolic arrest. About 20% went into a shockable rhythm. And then we have some other categories that I don't know how to explain. They're other.
All right.
I don't know what this other between shockable and non-shockable. It mm-hmm. seems pretty dichotomous to me. But there is an other category. And there's some patients that we just didn't know.
Yeah.
We couldn't pull that out.
Again, the challenge of a big registry data set.
That's
like
right.
this. All right. So what are the take-home points?
Oh, one more piece that
yeah,
we looked
yeah.
at. Was how many of those patients actually got return of spontaneous circulation?
Duh. So, yeah, that's kind of important.
Kind
so
of important, right? You know, for cardiac arrest as a whole, in the literature, it shows somewhere between, I don't know, 3 all the way to 15 or 18% survival.
Yeah.
Survival. We
and
can't
just to
really
be clear
measure.
There, you're talking about all cause.
Correct.
So when you hear, well, Seattle's at 60%. That's Utstein survival. That's not all-cause survival.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. And so the Utstein is those patients who have the best chance of surviving. Everything.
Good point. So define that for us. What is that? What's
so Utstein is witnessed with bystander CPR, and they had a shockable rhythm.
There we go.
So those are the when the Swiss cheese all lines up.
Right.
Those are the patients that can actually get all the way through and come out on the other side pretty well.
Yeah.
Everybody else, they've got to hit some bumps along the road. Either they didn't get bystander CPR or they didn't have a shockable rhythm. There's lots of reasons why patients' outcomes can become a little worse.
So a lot of people will say, well, that's just cherry picking. You can't do that. We don't care. And I think the argument, and I buy this, I think it's a reasonable argument, that the reason we use Utstein is not because that's the only thing we care about, because it's not. We care about moving the needle on all-cause cardiac arrest, but we're using Utstein as a marker here for the efficacy of your system. Mm-hmm. So no matter how good your system is, you're not going to change the nursing home patient who's been dead for 3 days. So it's not fair to, as a performance measure, look at that. We still want to look, as a public health measure, what all-cause mortality is. That's a good point.
And it's a way to more precisely compare yourself with other systems.
Benchmark.
Because some systems have a very, very low threshold for attempting resuscitation.
Yes.
And some other
is
systems...
the head still attached to the body?
Right. Some other systems, maybe not.
Right. Correct.
Some other systems may have a little bit more aggressive non-start protocols.
Yep.
And so... It's a way to sort of level set that difference in philosophy.
So what are your take-homes?
Our take-homes are really our EMS witnessed matches the all-cause cardiac arrest.
And I'm going to have to pause here. And we're back. Sorry for the interruption. Had a medical control call. So what are the takeaways on this cardiac arrest paper?
So... this is a very large national data set. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty representative of EMS systems across the U.S. Less than 15% of the cardiac arrests were witnessed by EMS. Half of those were in patients who were 65 or less. And about only one in five patients really presented in a shockable rhythm.
Okay.
And so... I think there's lots of opportunities here to recognize who is the highest risk of going into EMS witness cardiac arrest and try to get some preventative measures. Because unfortunately, we can't measure who didn't go into cardiac arrest, right?
Right.
Because that's everybody else. But very few of those patients were at risk of going into cardiac arrest. I do suspect that we had some medics that recognized a really, really sick patient, intervened, mm-hmm. and prevented some of those patients from going into cardiac arrest.
You certainly.
I just don't know how to measure that.
Yeah, that's really the challenge. So I think the benefit here is that there's nothing that we're going to change in our practice based on this, but it is helpful to help begin to describe the population here. Yep, I think that's good.
And more to be discussed. There was at the last ESO. PCRF research workshop. Another group took this project and started to dive down into some of the deeper the data. So more information to be discussed soon. But I foresee some combined efforts here in one really nice manuscript.
Oh, that would be outstanding. So why don't we jump into another project that you've been working on? And this is decreasing medical errors. And I believe what you're looking at is the impact that adoption of the hand-heavy application had. So can you tell us about that project?
So the idea behind this project came from the fact that we historically, San Antonio Fire Department, Office of the Medical Director, and the Health Science Center have always used and taught and subscribed to the Broslow tape.
Okay.
Well, the limitation of the Broslow tape is it just doesn't have all of the critical interventions that we are interested in. We were looking for something a little bit more comprehensive.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started using another phone app that is we thought would be really helpful. Because essentially what it does is you select your patient age, and that roughly corresponds to a patient weight. And then it takes all the math out of having to do drug calculations. The app knows what the concentration of our medicine is, and it tells you by weight exactly what volume to give. So it tells you give 0.3 milliliters of this medicine, rather than having to go and estimate the patient's weight and figure out what the mgs per mil. And it's just hard to do when you have a really, really sick patient in front of you.
And this is the hand-heavy app.
This is the hand-heavy app.
Okay, perfect. Yes. We don't have to keep saying it, but I think most of us are familiar with the app, so it does help to know more or less what we're talking about. So, and those protocols are based on your protocols, not generic recommendations, but on what you have on your trucks.
Right. The app is custom tailored to our system, and it's adaptable. You know, in this current day of today, fentanyl is available. Tomorrow, I can get fentanyl, but it's a completely different concentration and a bigger bottle. So it's customizable to what we're actually carrying.
Yeah. Interesting. Good stuff. Okay. Now, what was the population you were studying?
We are looking at basically two populations, San Antonio Fire Department EMS patients under 13 years of age who received either fentanyl for pain or midazolam for seizures.
Okay. And so your inclusion you mentioned was under 13 received fentanyl or received midazolam. And any exclusions other than over 13 and didn't get these things?
Right. That's basically it. No, it was patients who either needed pain management or were in some sort of neurologic extremis.
And I'm not familiar with this project, so I'm just shooting in the blind here, but I'm assuming this was an observational study.
It was a interrupted time series.
Okay. So explain that. What does that mean?
So we did an intervention.
Okay.
And we wanted to look at before the intervention and compare that to after the intervention.
Okay.
And then we had a 6-month, what we call a wash-in period.
Yep.
So 6 months at the beginning of the year, looking at the old way to do it, and then we taught our paramedics the new system, and then we looked to see how much medication error was happening after the implementation of the app.
An interrupted time series sounds like that is a fancy way of saying a before and after.
Correct.
Okay. And you mentioned a wash-in phase. Is this in that period where people were getting used to the app and being trained on it? Did you include data from that period in your analysis?
No, but we didn't. Okay. We weren't looking at that because there was a transition. It takes an agency the size of San Antonio Fire Department. It's a effort to get everybody trained up, and it's impossible to do it in a short period of time. So it took a while.
And I think that's actually a strength here because of this methodology. Is because if you were to include data in that in between period, you would have some people who were trained on the new device, some people who weren't, and it would really kind of muck it up and make it dirty. So was this prospectively collected, or after you had implemented it, did you go back and look?
It was retrospective. Okay. With respect to, we waited till we reached the 6-month mark after implementation.
Okay.
And then we went back and looked at everything.
Very good. And what was your primary outcome here? What were you looking at?
The primary outcome was overall reduction in medication errors. And we defined a medication error as plus or minus 10% of the correct dose.
Aha. So you were not... this was not self-reported dosing errors. This was you're looking at the variation between what they say they gave and what you calculate they should have gotten.
Correct.
Perfect. Now, since there are two ways of, you have to know what they're, so how did you base what your gold standard, what they should have gotten? How did you determine what they should have, the amount they should have gotten?
Essentially, we did it through the same methodology that the Hentevi app uses.
Okay.
It's based on the patient's age. And because really both of these drugs are water drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And so their ideal weight, regardless of what their actual body weight is, really these drugs are based on the patient's ideal weight.
So you used for your gold, so it's a per kilo dosing. So you needed to somehow figure out what the kilograms were.
Correct.
And you based that on their age?
Yes.
Okay. And you based that on their age for the before and after group?
Correct.
All right. And then you calculated what that was, and then you compared what they actually gave to what they should have gotten.
What they documented they gave.
Okay. And then, so that was your primary outcome. How did you measure it? So the difference you were looking at.
So basically we just compared what the ideal weight we calculated versus what they documented as what they gave.
So I'm sorry, I probably didn't. I think I just repeated myself three times, and you're like, Jesus, Jeff, I've already answered this. How did you report that? So was it a variation, and you're looking at mean or median?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, so these are continuous variables, and yeah. So yes, we did. We looked at that, and basically what we looked at was the difference. So each medication administration was a discrete event, mm-hmm. and we looked at plus minus the thing, and then we considered anything greater than 10% of the dose to be an error. And so that was where it became dichotomous, it was categorical.
So you reported it you reported the proportion of patients with a med error?
And the delta, how far
so
off
two,
they were.
Two things. You Correct. Had two measures that you were... So ultimately, you have two groups, before and after, mm-hmm. and you have two measures in each group that you're comparing. You're
Correct.
Comparing the proportion of patients with a med error before and after, and you're comparing... I'm assuming you did median and IQR, or
yes.
did you do mean and standard?
So, standard deviation.
Okay, so mean and standard deviation. And then for the absolute nerds, so EMS... Lighthouse Project Podcast is known for our nerddom. So what...
Yeah, fit right in.
Exactly. What statistical test did you use for the proportion?
For the proportion, we just use a t-test. 95% confidence intervals.
Okay. For the categorical?
For the categorical, we used Fisher exact test.
Okay.
Chi-square.
Chi-square, there we go. All right. And then for the continuous. So you're looking at, you said you were reporting mean and standard deviation?
Yes.
Okay.
And mean, standard deviation, and 95% confidence. Level.
Okay. Outstanding. So let's just cut to the chase. What'd you find?
Well, I think probably the most interesting thing, the two most interesting pieces mm-hmm. of information were we gave more medications after the implementation of the Antevi.
Interesting.
And our age for the fentanyl was pretty much the same,
okay.
but our age for the Versed was significantly lower. The mean age was.
So you're giving it more often and you're giving it to younger patients.
Correct.
So did you look to see whether there had been an influx of young children with seizure disorders that moved to San Antonio during this time, or did you compare it to historical standards? Or
I don't really know how to do that.
Okay, fair enough.
We don't have a... I mean, we can look at how many seizure patients overall we ran, but I don't think that's necessarily reflective of the patients who are actually having... Okay. who are sick by EMS standards. Because, I mean, we have a lot of seizure kids that, you know, typical, right? EMS, by the time EMS gets there,
exactly.
the kids are waking up and they're fine, right? Remarkably, a lot of patients survive seizures.
It is amazing, isn't it?
It is.
You know, so I went to residency. One of my attendings was Dr. John Jaffe, and he actually trained as a pediatrician before he cross-trained in emergency medicine. And he said, Jeff, I got to tell you, here's what you do for seizures. The nurse or the tech runs in and says, patient seizing, get in here. And you go, okay, and you get up and follow them out the door. They turn left to go to the seizing patient. You turn right to go to the coffee pot. Pour yourself a cup of coffee, enjoy it. Then go to the patient's room, and by the time you get there, they will have stopped seizing, and you didn't have to do something that could have some adverse events. So I like it. First off, just ignore them for a little bit. And there is no way I actually just said that. That would be horrible advice. I wouldn't want to pass that on to anyone.
Well, no. I absolutely agree with that. In fact, whenever I was teaching this to my medics, I just asked a simple question is, do patients breathe while they're having a seizure?
Yeah, good, good.
And, you know, I'll get a mixed reaction,
yeah.
yes, and say, okay. So do all patients breathe while they're having a seizure? Get a mixed reaction, and then I say, okay, have you ever seen a seizure last 5 minutes? And everybody's like, yes.
Right.
Can anybody in this room hold their breath for 5 minutes and exercise?
Mm-hmm.
Because essentially that's what your seizure patient's
Absolutely.
Doing. And so clearly patients breathe while they're having a seizure. Maybe you need to help them a little bit, a little BVM.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get aggressive.
Yep.
Don't get terrible. But
there is some movement of gas going on.
That is correct.
Awesome. So what can we take away from this this research?
So the other sort of interesting piece of information that I found was, and this was completely unexpected for me, I figured the medication errors would be sort of on both sides. We'd have, you know, some of our patients would be getting overdosed, some of our patients would be getting underdosed, but pre-deployment of the Hantevi app, almost all of our patients were being underdosed for both medications.
Okay.
Once we deployed the app, we cut our greater than 10% down significantly, and we started giving more. We stopped underdosing our patients.
Okay, so from a proportional, your dichotomous variable, what was it before? Just proportion of patients with a med error. What did it go from in the before, and what did it end up with in the after?
So, for example, for Versed. We had 43 correct doses in total. 96% of those were overdoses. 4% were underdoses.
Okay.
And after deployment, it was much closer. It was 44% were underdosed, 29% were overdosed, and the rest of it was the correct administration.
And honestly, if I had to choose between underdosing and overdosing Versed in seizure patients, I'm going to vote for overdosing every day.
Right.
What's the worst thing that could happen? Well, they could have respiratory depression. Turns out we know what to do for that. And if you look at the pediatric literature on seizure cessation, the main thing that causes intubation in seizing kids is seizing. So the sooner you interrupt the seizure, the better the odds of not intubating them.
And that's exactly what the Rampart trial showed, exactly. Right? Go big or go home.
Even in adults, yeah.
And even if you go big, patients still do better.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Wampel, I really appreciate this. I think we've covered three interesting papers that have been presented here at EMS World Expo. We talked about isopropyl alcohol compared to IV ondansetron, and it turns out they both work equally well, or both don't work
poorly.
Equally well. We also talked about the epidemiology of EMS witnessed cardiac arrest, and we talked about using an app-based device based on age to calculate dosing of medications, and turns out using that, it decreases the underdosing and increases the likelihood that you're actually going to get the medication. Great stuff. Again, thank you very much for joining us.
I really enjoyed it.
This is a lot of fun. Thanks.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the FlightBridge Ed podcast family and a Fire Dog production. Visit FlightBridgeEd.com for more information.